finished. And defense on a dissertation having to do with baptism and craft and a reflection upon pastoral liturgical practice in the Church of Sweden. And
In the Uniting Church
the
in
United, thank you,
Sweden.
and the United Church, the Oikumenia Kyrkan, which is a church composed of the of Methodist, Baptist, and Mission Church communities. Joel also has a is it an MDiv?
Master's of Theology,
Yeah,
yeah.
Master of Theology from St. Vladimir's Seminary. And he currently is involved. You have two ecumenical communities of which you are a regular part. I suspect you may have some questions about that, particularly about not negative questions, mind you, but particularly the Birkasabi community. So there's lots to talk about, and I'll leave the floor to you.
Right,
Hey, welcome.
right. Thank you for giving me this chance. At the end of the day, I will need a lot of help from the spirit to keep you awake, I guess. Do you want me to mention something about the Birkasabi community?
Would you please?
Yeah, I can take a couple of minutes for that. So it's called the Ecumenical Community of Bjärka-Säby, which is a castle outside of Linköping, about 3 hours from here. And it's a lay, monastically inspired community with people from all over the Nordic countries, about 200 people, something like that, with a center around the ca this castle of Bjärka-Säby. And this grew out of say Pentecostal milieu, but also with this clear ecumenical goal. And so people gather there for retreats, get together to kind of ecumenically, receptively receive from different church tradition. It's focused on liturgy. The prayer of the hours. That has taken a lot of inspiration from the Coptic, from ecumenical contact with the Coptic Church, but also the Catholic slash ecumenical community of Monasterio di Bolce in northern Italy. And I would say it's based partly on the vision by Pope John Paul II that the church need to use both its of her lungs, both the Eastern and the Western. I could say a lot about, more about this, but I will go into my talk here. So this is an attempt to bring part of my dissertation work that I defended last week in dialogue with some themes in liturgical theology, and especially the concept of the ordo as understood by Father Alexander Schmemann and others. And in my dissertation, I only touch upon these on this subject, and I see this only as a kind of initial exploration that needs more development. But I think this is a good context for that. Many Schmemann that know Schmemann a lot more than I do, so bear with me. I already know that I have to read Hughes, was his name right? Worship as Meaning,
Yes, huge.
Hughes and Plus. Well,
Yes.
I'm not good with names. I will first just give a brief introduction to my study and then just bring it in dialogue with the concept of the ordo. So my dissertation is called The Craft of Baptism, Creative Liturgical Tactics in the Church of Sweden and the Uniting Church in Sweden. And for a long time, the field of practical theology has seen an increasing interest in practices and the use of qualitative methods to study concrete practices in the church, in the church, in the churches. So earlier, many studies of liturgy have concentrated on texts. However, although an increasing number of studies have explored concrete liturgical situations. Relatively few have investigated pastors and priests, with a focus on pastors and priests as liturgical actors. And so the purpose of my dissertation has been to deepen the understanding of pastors and priests as liturgical actors. So baptism is basically my case, but what I'm actually studying the phenomena is priests as liturgical actors. And just shortly, I'm not gonna bog you down with French theorists, but I bring qualitative methods, interviews, observations of pastors and priests in the baptismal situation. I interview them afterwards, but I bring this material in conversation with the French cultural theorist Michel de Certeau. I don't know if you know about him, but also the Swedish philosopher Jonna Bornemark, and as well the French thinker Bruno Latour. So I use them to analyze the material I have gathered. And Michel, just shortly about him, Michel de Certeau wanted to show how everyday practices such as cooking, walking the city, grocery shopping, watching TV is more than just a passive acceptance of already made circumstances, already made rules for behavior. He wanted to go beyond kind of a structuralist understanding of practices. And although a person who walks through the city does not have much power to say about the creation of the circumstances in which that person walks, it does not necessarily do this in the way that the city planner, the architect, the politicians have planned or thought they should do. The person walking can do unexpected things, use the streets and park and walkways in new creative ways. And the given circumstances, so these given circumstances, the planned things, this is what calls strategy. But the way that people, common people, everyday practitioners actually use this given circumstances, he calls tactics. So that's the basic theoretical idea that I use. And I have used this and tried to develop it in relation to the priests and pastors as liturgical actors. And especially, I've looked at and understood the liturgical handbooks and the liturgical space as this strategy that they kind of have to, they cannot affect that, but they have to, that's their starting point basically. And how they use this in creative ways. And this is not necessarily a type of creativity that creates new, like brand new liturgical, forms, but it's more like a low-key kind of liturgical creativity needed to actualize what the liturgical texts write about in a specific context, in unique circumstances. And depending on the liturgical tradition that is being studied, the type of creativity should differ, but I suggest that a certain level of creativity is needed in leading any liturgical event. And so analyzing my material, I have described how priests and pastors tactically then, using the concept of tactics, use the church space and the liturgical books, the text of the books. I describe kind of a tactical adjustment of the liturgy. I describe how they make smaller, larger adjustments of the liturgical language, how they sometimes make reformulations, mix different alternatives of the liturgical text, make additions of different kinds, sometimes just a small pedagogical explanation this is what we're going to do now. And in baptismal situation, oftentimes they are dealing with a lot of people not necessarily very accustomed to being in church, especially in the Church of Sweden. So ways of involving the congregation, but also prayers formulated in the moment at times, taken also prayers from other liturgical sources. In addition, I have seen addition of things that are not necessarily mentioned in by the handbook, such as different kinds of liturgical movements, signing of the cross, lighting of candles. Introduction of liturgical objects and so forth. In addition, I show how the liturgists exercise what I have named and called liturgical discernment, using Jonas Bornemark in this, or judgment, Swedish omdöme, kind of a practical knowledge. Seeing these adjustments of different kinds as an expression of practical knowledge that combine sense perceptions, feelings, experiences, theoretical knowledge to find ways in the moment to adjust the given aspects of liturgy to practical circumstances. And when it comes to the motivations behind these smaller or larger adjustments, the liturgists express a variety of reasons. It could be theological, liturgical reasons, pedagogical reasons, reasons having to do with increasing the participation of the people present, but also just practical, pragmatic reasons. I will give you a couple of examples from the analysis. For example, the priest in the Swedish church that I have called Torbjörn, basically before the liturgy starts, but I guess it becomes the actual beginning of the liturgy, he adds a prayer. He says a few introductory words, and then he prays a short prayer. And I will try to say something about the prayer. So I'm just translating it, reading it in Swedish here. But God, we come to you and we thank you that we can gather here today and together with you and with each other. Come to us with your good Holy Spirit, bless us and our service in Jesus' name. Amen. So this is in a very simple prayer that he adds, but at the same time, it includes quite a lot. It includes a prayer of the Spirit coming over the service and those gathered together. It includes a benediction and and so on. Another even smaller example I write about is Frida, who in the introduction, introductory words of the service that is in the book, she explicitly calls their gathering, this is welcome to this worship service. When I ask her about this, she actually mentions the word worship service that is not included in the actual text of liturgy, gudstjänst in Swedish. And she mentioned it four times. And then when I asked her about it, she's very conscious about this. She really wants to emphasize that this is not just this kind of family gathering, which it has it can easily be perceived that this more kind of a family event by a lot of quite secularized Swedish persons. Another example from the Ecumenia Church is how, I mean, they it's a denomination that combines the baptism of children, but also baptism as for I don't know what you would call it in English, but as confessing or adult baptism, yeah. Anyway, and you have these, they're trying to combine this and have been able to do this, but they have felt a risk that the different types of baptisms are seen as different things. They're not the same, liturgical happening. They look differently, they use different methods for baptism, and so on. So a very kind of thought through, they have used the liturgical space to emphasize that these the baptism of children and baptism of adults are the same by just basically always trying to do the baptismal, the baptism to the left side of the sanctuary. And while they also have this practice of blessing of children, which actually, when you see it, looks very much like baptism of children. And in the beginning, they would do that at the same place where you have the baptism of children, and it very much looks like it's very, very similar. So they have decided to place this practice of children's blessing to the right side of the sanctuary. Anyway, so that's shortly some examples. I now go into saying something about the liturgical theology and the concept of the ordo. Both within the modern liturgical movement and within liturgical theology, there has been a tendency, I would argue, to forget the liturgical actor. Central to the modern liturgical movement has been the effort to include the whole people in the life of the in the life of worship. I have therefore tried to focus on the experience of the liturgical leader, the liturgist. I have kind of crossed out a few things, so if you feel that it doesn't all fit together, I'm sorry for that, but I want to try to get through the whole thing, the whole argument. An important concept in Schmemann's liturgical theology is the ordo. And even if many of the issues that Schmemann dealt with in his introduction to liturgical theology does not always have direct relevance to other liturgical traditions than the Orthodox, his understanding of the order can contribute to my study, I believe. However, I will take some liberties in my appropriation of Schmemann into a different ecclesial context. Ordo then refers to, on one level, to the structure and order of worship as codified in liturgical books, the rules, instructions for the celebration of worship. And he also says that it is the study and elucidation of the ordo that is the most important task for liturgical theology, according to Schmemann. However, there is no simple correlation between the codified service in liturgical books and what Schmemann understands as the ordo. And Schmemann describes a number. This is very basic Schmemann knowledge. I understand this, but I want to go through it. He describes a number of problems to grasp what the order is. In part, its size and scope is so great that it's actually impossible to act it out in full. He also problematizes the understanding of the ordo, the codified books, as an immutable norm, as it originates in concrete, local, and particular liturgical circumstances. And he believes that the ordo is often contradictory and obscure. And so he writes, I will quote him here, "We come to the conclusion, therefore, that the ordo is problematic both in scope and content, and that selectivity and judgment are required in its use, the application of criteria and premises which are not found within it in explicit form." So the use of the ordo correctly requires both selectivity and judgment. So he distinguishes then between the codified form and the immutable norm for worship of the church, which he understands as the worship in spirit and truth that Jesus speaks about in the Gospel of John. And this is my reading, but in this understanding, the order becomes more this kind of ideal heavenly service to which concrete liturgical books are certainly related to, but not completely captured by them. And Schmemann believes that the structure of worship can be found in the concrete ordo, but that discernment is needed for this. And when he speaks about this discernment, he says that understanding of the spiritual and theological meaning of the ordo is needed. You have to understand the basic structure and the fullness of the ordo, its general philosophy or the logos of the worship. And so the task of liturgical theology is to find out how the different parts of the ordo correlate with each other, and which part are more central than others. And he argues to study the development of the liturgy over time to better understand this kind of fundamental structure, in contrast to temporary, sometimes even problematic, concrete expressions. Schmemann argues that the church in its worship practices always relates to the spiritual norm, the ordo in the ideal sense, which never fully correlates with actual forms of worship. But I am happy to be corrected in this, but for, as I understand, at least in the introduction to liturgical theology, discernment becomes primarily something that academic liturgical theologians exercise by distinguishing between the order's fundamental elements. It's a pretty advanced type of discernment with in which you need a lot of knowledge and temporary, distinguish between the fundamental elements, the temporary expressions. And the theologian can do this through historical study, theological analysis, and the result in liturgical theology tends to be a search for ideal historical forms of worships that could then influence reforms of liturgy, maybe even liturgical books, and things like that. At the same time, the individual liturgist is the one who primarily uses the liturgical books, the ordo in its particular forms, in concrete liturgical situations. And when Schmemann then claims that selectivity and judgment are required in its use, the consequence of that should be, in my mind, that liturgical theology also pays more attention to the significance of the liturgist in the celebration of the liturgy. So in line with Schmemann, we can ask what it means for the individual liturgies to relate discernment and judgment, and in this way adapt how the liturgy is carried out in relation to some kind of understanding of the ordo. And would look very different in different liturgical traditions. And one can hardly assume, like looking at the Swedish church and the Ekumenia Kyrka, as I have done, that excuse me, I lost myself here. Yeah, what cannot assume that in a general way that liturgists actually relate to this idea of the ordo, and much less Schmemann's understanding of it. On the other hand, based on my studies analysis, it is possible to argue that liturgists use discernment, judgment to tactically adjust, change, and adapt in smaller ways, not the like the actual central parts of the text of the liturgy, but maybe small additions to bring in people to bring them in, add to the participation, maybe adjust a few words to make it more relatable, and so on. Bring in liturgical objects and such things, liturgical movements in special ways, and so on. And that they do this, among other things, based on a theological motivation, based on their own perception of what constitutes good liturgy. And I think this can be strengthened, this argument can be strengthened by also reformulating the understanding of the ordo. I think his description of the ordo as logos opens up for understanding of the ordo more in terms of logic or grammar, and I'm not the only one to see this, but instead of speaking about an ideal form of worship or a given structure, one can speak of a language or grammar of the liturgy. So I have tried to use George Lindbeck's cultural linguistic understanding of doctrine in the book Nature of Doctrine to help me understand the ordo in this more grammatical sense, but this also connects to a more hermeneutical approach to the ordo found in Gordon Lathrop's understanding, for example. But Lindbeck says about religious traditions and its teachings as a kind of grammatical system, it comprises a vocabulary of discursive and non-discursive symbols together with a distinctive logic or grammar in terms of which this vocabulary can be meaningfully deployed. And I think I will have to skip a few lines, but so my hope is to deepen this this discussion, and I'm hopeful to get input from people here in the part of that are here today. By describing the ordo as a vocabulary and a grammar more than an ideal form of worship, specific expressions of this grammar, concrete liturgical practices, come into focus. In such an understanding, the leading liturgist also becomes decisive for how this grammar is expressed down to actual very small details. And it is the liturgist who actually express major parts. Now, of course, not by himself, it's the whole congregation. But my focus here has been to discuss the liturgist a part in this, and he or she could then be understood as the grammarian of the liturgy, the one who gives concrete form to the language and grammar of the liturgy. And I can just connect back. I'll just say a couple of more things and then open up for questions. As I said about Torbjörn, who added this prayer in the beginning of baptism, he in the interview, I asked him about this, and he says that he did this because he wants to emphasize that we are here before God. And in the actual handbook for baptism, the first prayer comes quite late in the service. And for him, it was important to really emphasize that what we're doing here is something that we do before God. And for him, the most natural thing to do is to formulate some kind of prayer. And I think you can argue that you can understand this as a kind of tactical adjustment grounded in a certain discernment of the grammar of liturgy in a large sense. And in this case, a basic understanding of baptism as the encounter between God and man. Another last thing I will mention is that Frida, a priest in the Swedish church, encouraged her parishioners to, she had learned this from a priest in her when she grew up, that while you walk down the aisle to receive communion, you can say, "I am baptized in the name of Jesus," to yourself, to strengthen kind of the connection between baptism and the Eucharist. And I would say that what she discerned here is she's in reality, she's then making some kind of addition to the liturgy in some sense, because you're actually expressing certain words about the liturgy. And she here also discerns this crucial connection found in the Ordo between baptism and the Lord's and the Eucharist. And the connection between baptism and the Eucharist is emphasized in the church handbook in one way in initial statements, but it's actually not visible in the actual text of the baptismal liturgy. Anyway, I will stop there, I think.
Thank you. Thank you, James.
Thank you very much, Joel. I'm just thinking as you're talking about the Ordo and its ritual significance, its theological significance, was there any consciousness at all in particularly the Ecumenes pastor you talk with, any historical debate, as there has been, as you know, among Protestants, at least some Protestants, Free Church folks in particular, about the applicability of Schwemann's understanding of Ordo, because they argue you can't find it historically like Schwemann claims you can. And so if you can't find that regulative ecumenical Ordo, then that opens the door to a kind of freedom for the Ordo that Free Church practice would want to emphasize.
Well, I would say this. I mean, I don't discuss this with the pastors that I interview, but in the creation of the handbook for Ecumena Kyrkan, the concept or the idea of the Ordo, as understood, I mean, partly by Schmemann, but also by the, you know, liturgical movement, Lathrop and so on, is very much present. Mm-hmm. And they try to combine the sense of structure inspired by the, you know, traditional forms of worship, and try to find ways to combine this with a certain amount of freedom, successful or not.
Okay, thank you very much.
Other questions?
Thank you, Joel, for your presentation. Enjoyed thinking about the role of the liturgist in strategy and tactics, and that even in a very set liturgy, some of the creative ways and examples you gave with baptism. And then you spoke just a little bit about at the end of someone coming up to take communion and saying to herself, "I've been baptized." There, it seems like there's a within the strategy of a liturgy or the ordo, like there's also a tactical or creative element for the worshiper. And I wondered if you could comment on that, if you interviewed maybe any of the worshipers and how they may engage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, I did not at all interview any only priests and pastors, but of course that could be a very interesting study in itself. So this was just something that one of the priests told me, that she encouraged the congregation to say this as a kind of way of connecting baptism and the Eucharist while receiving it.
Hi, sir. Thanks for your talk. I just wanted to comment, actually, it's not a question, but the structure that you presented got me thinking about so many services in different churches, but not least Orthodox, where that creativity is very present. For every category, I can think of a concrete priest on how working with the exact same text, the same ordo in one place. Every priest spoke differently, in small, subtle ways. The ones that you mentioned are probably very, very helpful.
Right.
So I'll be thinking about that next time I attend the liturgy. And you've got all of the additions. You've got also very helpful things like reading some prayers aloud and others silently.
Right.
I'm sure many are aware of that. Sometimes it's a contentious issue. A lot of the times it's just discernment or tact.
Right.
The priest may read a prayer very loudly occasionally, but other times silently.
Right.
So there's a lot of creativity going on in applying the exact same. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your comment. I appreciate you seeing that, and I would love to maybe sometime also do kind of apply this to an Orthodox context.
Super
interesting. Because it's interesting because even if it's small adjustments, like you say, they have theological significance. And so it's a theological, deeply theological work that is being done, or craft, as I like.
I'll give another example of that, if I may. Just in our parish in Kuku, we have a new priest who's Greek, and then he's ministered in Finland all his life. Replacing our former vicar, who was from Romania, and in establishing a kind of an altar servant group, he and we talked about how the way that he performed, enacted, presided at the service in lots of ways, sometimes small, sometimes larger, were going to be different from his predecessor.
Mm.
And that he wanted us to know exactly what we had to do as altar servers to make sure that he and we were on the same page.
Right.
But that kind of difference, is pretty pronounced, actually, in Orthodox parishes.
Mm.
If you consider where the priest was educated.
Right.
Like I say Vladimir's, right? I think there's a certain way in which that liturgy is enacted.
Right.
And other places are different.
Yeah, and I would assume that this kind of consciousness of the theological importance of what you're actually doing in the movements is pretty present in the Orthodox tradition, more or less, I guess, different in different persons. And my hope is, I guess part of my hope with the dissertation is actually to make this awareness of the theological importance of this, the even the small changes and the enactments of the text and so on in liturgy in general, also in other traditions. Yeah.